Podcasting from behind her locked bathroom door, the only quiet place in the house, this is the Homeschool Sanity Show, a twice-monthly podcast with expert advice for happier, healthier homeschool living. And now, here's your host, Christian psychologist and homeschool mom of six, Dr. Melanie Wilson.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Homeschool Sanity Show. Today, we're talking about parenting blind spots that put your homeschool family at risk. And my guest is Reb Bradley. He is a father of six. He's a pastor who ministers to the body of Christ at large. He's been a radio counselor and a talk show host. He is a writer and a national conference speaker, and he draws from the scriptures as well as his mistakes and successes to strengthen the modern Christian family. He conducts seminars internationally and teaches extensively on issues related to marriage, fatherhood, child training, and single Christian living. Reb is most noted for his best-selling book, Child Training Tips, What I Wish I Knew When My Children Were Young. Reb and his wife, Beverly, have taught all six of their grown children at home. I happen to be a big fan of Reb's work. I have viewed his videos on child training in the early years and also parenting teens with the Wisdom of Solomon. I have used them in my church. I viewed them with other homeschoolers, and I've read at least one of his books, and I'm planning on reading more. As a psychologist who is in the process of parenting and homeschooling my own children, I find his advice to be just of great value. It's submitted humbly with the counsel of Scripture, and it really does work. So we're going to dive in and talk about those parenting blind spots that we have. But first, I'm going to ask Reb to tell us a little bit more about him and his family and what they're up to these days.
Sure. Well, as you said, six kids homeschooled them all. I think right now the ages are 18 to 35. That's quite a spread, which makes my wife and I empty nesters. So it's an unusual thing. My daughter, my youngest 18-year-old, we're presently, she's in California, we're in Colorado. So it's strange for us to be not parents with kids in the home for this season. My wife finished homeschooling just a couple of years ago, 27 years of homeschooling. So she was exhausted at the end of that 27 years, and she's thrilled that that season is done. But it's interesting. We're here in Colorado, and the church we're associated with here has a co-op homeschool, or I'm sorry, kind of a co-op school full of homeschoolers. And so she mentors the teenage girls, about eight of them. And so she hasn't stopped teaching. We came here within 2 months. They tapped her for that, and she said, absolutely. So she's mentoring a handful of teenage girls, and it's just she's loving it. So anyway, that's what we're doing right now.
Well, that's wonderful, and I'm sure you're keeping busy traveling and speaking as well.
Oh, you know what? Nonstop. In fact, though I've been the parenting guy for years, lately, the Lord has done something different in my ministry, and I have a website called ultimatehusband.com, and it's thriving, but it's mostly men whose wives have left them, Christian guys whose wives have left them. They contact me every day, nonstop. I mean, we're talking about dozens of men each week saying, please help me know how to get reconciled with my wife. So I spend a lot of time with men these days, just counseling them about what it means to be a husband, what it means to be a father.
Well, I have some men that I'm going to point in your direction. Unfortunately, that's a very sad reality, isn't it?
It is. Well, you know, 70% of all divorces, both Christian and otherwise, are pursued by women. 70%, about two-thirds, really, of all divorces. And that means that they're wounded, they're hurt, and they ultimately give up, and they say, I can't bear with this anymore, and in desperation they leave, and then their husbands wake up and say, oh my goodness, what have I done, and then they contact me. And so my heart goes out to these guys, but it's a reality. Maybe another show, another time. But
yes, I think so, definitely. Well, I wanted to know, since you've been homeschooling for so long, or you were up until a couple of years ago, what led you to homeschool in the first place?
Well, you know, we were from the 70s, and, you know, 70s was kind of 60s, 70s was a free age of being a free spirit. And so we just, after we had our first son in 79, we said, you know, we can't imagine turning him over to somebody else to raise. Now, my wife was a school teacher. She taught in public, and she was teaching in a Christian school when we got married. And we just thought, why do we want somebody else to have our son or daughter 7-8 hours a day and influence them? So that was basically it. We just thought we didn't want somebody else raising our kids, and that was going to be the best way to ensure that we were their primary influence.
All right. That's interesting. I find it interesting to ask all of my guests what led them to homeschool in the first place, because you get such a wide range of answers. But it's interesting that she was already teaching and she still felt that she really wanted to have that, and you with her have that primary influence in the home.
Well, you know, Raymond Moore was on Folks on the Family back then, and he was starting to talk about this homeschooling. And even though it was radical and new, we just felt like it was necessary. In fact, most homeschoolers who started back in the 70s and 80s were on the edge. You never knew if someone was going to show up to your house to try to arrest you. So there was a measure of risk, you know. We started doing interviews immediately. I was working in radio at the time, but reporters would come to the house and want to know about homeschooling. So you're always wondering, how much do I want to make this public? Because there was a risk to it. You had to develop your own curriculums because there weren't published curriculums that were out there. So, yeah, but it was obviously all worth it. It's not the same. When people homeschool now, they join into a huge movement. Back then, you hunted for other homeschoolers to create a cooperative effort, if that makes sense.
Yes. Yeah, it was a much different time. And I think that's what makes it even more interesting to ask people who've been doing it for a long time. All right. Well, as I said, we're going to talk about parenting blind spots that are common among homeschoolers. And the first thing that I want to say is that in having this discussion, we're not suggesting that everyone has these parenting blind spots. Certainly not. But some of us do. And the nature of a blind spot is that we cannot see it. We just don't realize that we're struggling in certain areas of parenting or making some mistakes. Do you think that there are parenting blind spots that are more common among homeschoolers?
Absolutely, but I don't think it's because of homeschooling at all. What I've observed, you know, having been a homeschooler for years, and I pastored for years. I retired about 10 years ago, but for the 18 years I was pastoring that church, I had planted it 18 years earlier. But it was primarily homeschoolers. In fact, I think it was about, at its peak, around 500 people. And about 90% were homeschooling their kids. And I just had a chance to watch these kids grow up. I watched them go into college. I watched them go into their 20s and marry. And I saw a phenomenon that concerned me. Even my own kids had their own struggles that shocked me. I had this picture that homeschooling would create the optimum human, and it never occurred to me that my children and all, even homeschool kids, are humans. They're self-determining individuals who decide what they're going to do with the training they receive. You know, a dog doesn't make that decision. You train a dog, the dog stays trained its whole life. You just, with minimal reinforcement, it'll come when you call it and salivate when you ring a bell, you know. But a human grows up and says, what am I going to do with this? And they make that decision. And I wasn't ready. So the homeschooling tends to, let me put it this way. Here's my conclusion after this. Homeschooling tends to attract parents who say, I want to have great control of my children's lives. I want to be the dominant influence in their lives. And so homeschoolers can sometimes, not because of homeschooling, which is normal for thousands of years of world history, but because of the opportunity to control their children, might end up out of balance in the area of parenting, especially when the kids reach their teen years. And they'll watch their kids go prodigal. And I was watching kids. One young man used to travel with me to my conventions and help at my book table. And we had great conversations, an earnest young man in high school. But his first year in college, he became an atheist. And how does that happen? This, but I was seeing it was not uncommon. The young kids would grow up and decide, what am I going to do with my faith? My second son went in the army and would call us, and he was having a crisis of his own faith. He'd lived this cloistered life full of homeschoolers, and the church was just this wonderful little circle of all these like-minded and similar valued people. And now in the army, he was running into people of various kinds of faiths that didn't know the Lord, didn't have a profession of faith, and he went through his own crisis of faith trying to determine what he believed. And we began to see that wasn't uncommon, that young people grow up and turn away from the values their parents sought to give them. And so we don't attribute this to homeschooling, but I attribute to just a more controlling style of parenting, that hence I have my book. It's a short paperback book called Solving the Crisis in Homeschooling, and it looks at 7 blind spots common to homeschoolers that increase the likelihood they will watch their children grow up and go prodigal.
Mm-hmm. And I really appreciate that you said increase the likelihood, because we're certainly not suggesting that if you have a child that is a prodigal, that you have this certain type of parenting style and you contributed to this. It's certainly not a 100% relationship, right? I mean, there are definitely kids who have their own individual issues, as you said. They're self-determining people. And we just want to minimize the risk of that, and we don't want to contribute to it.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, once again, it's really just simply this. Here's what it is. Parents call me, and they say, what do we do? Our adult children have gone astray. And I say, well, evaluate your parenting approach and determine if you helped contribute to it. There was something in your parenting that you did. Because I began to figure this out after my 3 oldest were out of the home. I began to evaluate and look and think, they've had struggles I didn't know they would have. And I began to evaluate my approach to parenting. And I began to conclude I'd made mistakes, which meant I changed how I parented my youngest 3. Plus, it meant I had coffee dates with my oldest 3. I would take them out to coffee and say, well, here's something I realized I made a mistake in your parenting. I just want you to know, I'm really sorry. This is what I regret. You'll notice I'm doing it differently with your younger brother and sisters. So that was our life, and it's part of us establishing adult relationships, if you will, just owning those things I can. So that's why I say I encourage any parent who has a prodigal to stop and think, have I done anything to contribute? And there's no guarantee you have. You know, mm-hmm. God made no mistakes as a parent, and yet he saw Israel grow up, if you will, and go astray many times over the generations. And yet God wasn't at fault to the story of the prodigal son. There was not suggested who God in the story is the father, that he had done something wrong. He just had 2 young adult sons who made choices and went astray. And so, so it's not always a parent's fault when they have prodigals, but it is wise to evaluate, have I done something to contribute?
I think that's an excellent piece of advice to give to all of us. It's always worthwhile taking time to consider and pray about how we're contributing to our children's lives, both positively and negatively. Well, let's jump in and talk about some of these things that can get in the way of our children following the Lord. What are some parenting blind spots that parents of young children often have?
Well, you know, parents of young children won't necessarily have the same blind spots as parents of older children. In fact, my biggest concern for parents of young children is actually vastly different from when those kids become teens. The biggest problem I see in modern America, whether it's homeschool or otherwise, parents tend to raise narcissistic hedonists. That is, our culture reflects narcissism unbelievably. Hedonism is a passion or a desire for personal gratification. And so those are in us at birth. We come out of the womb with the nature of this narcissistic, saying, I want to have my diaper changed. Wah, cry, you know, cry again. Oh, I want to be fed. Cry again. I want to go to take a nap. And in other words, we're born narcissistic, and the scripture calls it being born with a foolish nature or full of folly. But in essence, the Hebrew words used there describe narcissism. Now, the problem is, I mean, that's a good thing. It keeps us alive. It acquaints mom with the needs of a child. But by the time that child's a year old, that narcissism says, I don't just want to survive. I want to be gratified. I want to eat Twinkies and play on the freeway. I want to stay up late and approach dangerous dogs. In other words, that's what narcissism says. I want to have my way. And so parents, not their blind spots are this. They cater to these children's preferences. Instead of teaching the children self-control, the key ingredient to maturity, they teach the children that the life centers around them and their happiness. So they cater to children. Children grow up as teenagers, become more narcissistic, more entitled, because the parents were sending the message, it's what you want that is of supreme importance in our home. And the child says, oh, not squash again. I don't like meatloaf. So mom says, well, we have a pizza in the freezer. Why don't you get it out and cook it up? And but take a one a day, because there's no nutrition in that. So mom caters to the preferences rather than saying the path to maturity is paved with suffering, and I'm going to have you suffer through broccoli and squash and meatloaf.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, but most parents are afraid to let their children suffer through those things. They don't give them daily chores. Parents say to me, my child whines and complains when I give them a chore, and I say, oh, well, you obviously don't work them enough. If you work a child enough, they stop complaining. They think doing hard work is part of life.
Mm-hmm.
I've traveled the world. I mean, I've been in Uganda and watched people who would really suffer. But yet, they don't think they suffer. I'm talking about they live in mud huts. I was with people like that a number of years back and watched. They were in mud huts. They had to walk 2 miles with jugs every day to fill with water that wasn't drinkable, bring it back, boil it over a campfire. They were the happiest people I've ever seen. They didn't think they suffered. In America, we think we suffer when we can't find the TV remote or our internet connection is slow. We don't know how to suffer. We think we suffer when we're deprived of luxury. But our kids get that from us. And so we raise narcissists by spoiling them. We raise our children to be this way. The path to maturity, the Bible teaches, says Jesus was made perfect. Actually, the word in the Greek is he was made mature. Doesn't mean flawless, that Greek word. It meant mature. He was made mature through what he suffered. Suffering is what an athlete does to himself when he disciplines himself and becomes better. It's anyone who develops a skill, practices, and disciplines themselves. In other words, they suffer, and that suffering produces maturity in their area of skill. And so our children must face the suffering of life, which is picking up their toys, eating broccoli, talking respectfully, not complaining when they don't get the food they want for dinner, but saying, thank you, Mom, for working so hard for this. Thank you for this broccoli, or this thank you for this Brussels sprouts, or whatever the stuff is that they don't like. So to answer your question, that's the most basic blind spot modern parents have of young children. I mean, there's more. I mean, obviously, I do full weekend seminars on this, so I have to figure out what point I'm going to stop myself from.
Exactly.
So we can get through this interview.
I know one of the things, one of the analogies that you give in your parenting for young children videos that I have never forgotten is of like a policeman or woman who tells you that you have to move your car because you're parked illegally. And then if you just continued to walk away, refusing to move your car, if the parking officer would then say, you know, I'm going to count to three. And then if you don't do it, I'm going to give you a ticket. And then saying one, two, and then there's usually the 2.5, three quarters. And your point was we would have absolutely no respect for that officer if they behaved that way. Yet, as parents, when we are giving our children consequences for their choices, we can come across that way when we don't expect them to comply with what we say.
Absolutely. In fact, I would say that's probably one of the key things that I know transforms people's homes. they stop threatening. They stop repeating. The repeating is a huge blind spot in most homes. If a parent says, I'm not going to tell you again, the kid is thinking, of course you are. You're not even red in the face yet. I've got three more times before I have to obey you. How many times does I tell you? I don't know, but I'll count. That was three. So the parents threaten, and then they count, and then they repeat. Well, the repeating basically says to your child, I'm not worth listening to. I'm not respectable. Don't listen to me until I finally mean business. So we teach our children to disobey us, and then we get mad at them for disobeying, when we are the ones who taught them disregard us. Well, the point is, a child, if he can obey the fifth time, he demonstrates he has the capacity to obey. He's just waiting for you to be serious. What if you decide, I'll be serious the first time? Since you can't obey, from now on I'll tell you one time, and I'll tell you calmly, I'll tell you sweetly, I'll tell you musically. And so you make that decision. You watch your home transform. You stop repeating yourself. You're calm when you have to bring some kind of consequence. You're not out of control. There's no threat of child abuse because you're completely at peace because you made the decision to train them to obey you the first time and just stop repeating yourself. It makes a world of difference. Mm-hmm. I appreciate the reminder of that's a pretty key area of blind spots that parents have of young children.
Yes. Do you find that parents really need to know ahead of time what kinds of consequences they're going to give for disobedience? It seems a lot of times parents are struggling with that.
Sure. Well, in my book, Child Training Tips, I have a chapter where I actually have suggested responses. And so the Bible distinguishes between two different kinds of misbehavior. One is defiance and rebellion. In other words, they basically with their action or attitude are saying, I will not accept your authority to make a decision in my life. That's defiance. I'm going to do what I want, even though you made clear what you want. And they consciously do defy you. The serious consequence, the Bible talks about chastisement as a proper response for the defiance like that. But the other is just simply childish irresponsibility, maybe a thoughtless disobedience. You know, you tell the child to put the bike away. He doesn't do it again and again, not because he is trying to rebel. He just keeps forgetting. Well, so there needs to be a consequence. So I suggest following the biblical pattern of making the punishment fit the crime. They're irresponsible with their bike. They lose the bike for a season. They leave their clothes out. They don't put them away. They lose their clothes for a season and for a few days or a week, whatever. They leave the yard after you tell them not to. They lose the privilege of playing in that yard. That seems to be the biblical pattern or recommendation as we make the punishment fit the crime. And they're not being punished. It's not like they're atoning for their sin. It's a training consequence. They're reaping what they have sown in the natural. If they dirty something, make them clean it. If they break something, make them repair it or buy a new one. In other words, that's the and in the book I've got a whole little suggestion of how you determine how to create a consequence that matches the crime, if you will.
Yes, and that is an excellent resource for parents and to be, you know, planning ahead, because I find that a lot of times parents get really angry at disobedience when they don't have a consequence in mind to deal with that, or even to recognize that it's okay for a parent to say, I'm going to think about what just happened and I'm going to get back with you about what the consequence is going to be. That's certainly allowed and can actually make the consequence more effective for the child because they're wondering what on earth you're going to come up with.
Right.
So
right.
That is another tip. Well, unfortunately, I just witnessed this this week where a teenager was behaving like a very young disobedient child because obviously the parents didn't do the kinds of things that you suggest in your book and had a real problem on their hands. So the same kinds of parenting challenges can continue into the teen years. But there are other kinds of blind spots that happen for parents of teens, aren't there? And what are some of those?
Well, the ones that I caution parents against, about is based on the mistakes I made. I had a very authoritarian view of parenting teens, and I had actually written a short book on it called Parental Authority and Adult Children. And it's when I had my eyes opened about 10 years ago or so, or maybe 11 now, I woke up and said, what have I done? And I had a stack of those books on the shelf. They went right in the trash can. Because I had thought, I'm a Bible student. I'm a Bible teaching pastor. I like to teach through the Bible. And so when I have a question, my conviction is you go to the Word, you see what it says. I use the computer. I find every Greek word on a particular topic. I find every place it's referenced. Or I try to deduce the heart and mind of God based on what He's put in the Word. So I actually wrote a book on parenting teens back in 1996 or so, but I never published it. I never felt free to publish it, and it's a good thing I didn't, because I would have really messed up a lot of people's lives. I'm thankful the Lord checked me and stopped me from publishing that book, because what I woke up to was this. An authoritarian view of parenting, you can tell you have it in your home if you are consequence-oriented. In other words, if you try to keep control of your home based on, all right, you guys, and I'm talking about teenagers here, if this isn't done, we get back, or if you've done this, here's the consequence. You got it? You're in trouble. In threat of consequence is the chief means of motivating and training your teenagers. You're already treating them with a demeaning means. You're already gearing them up to become a prodigal, because that is a demeaning way to treat them. What happened was, like I said, close to 10 years ago, I decided just to give it a fresh look. I saw what was happening in the homes. I was watching what was occurring. These good kids growing up and going prodigal. Some were the poster children for homeschooling, it seemed, their parents felt. But I watched them go prodigal. And I went back and I studied Proverbs, and I realized Solomon did not talk to and train his teenage sons the way I had been encouraging parents to, which was very authoritarian. And as I studied through, I realized all of Proverbs was written and compiled for his teenagers. And yet, he wasn't threatening his sons at any point with a consequence. He'd say, when you are making these choices, teenage sons, when you're making these choices in life, be careful. If you hang out with an angry man, you're going to learn his ways. In other words, you're going to reap a negative consequence as a result of the relationships you develop. But he didn't say, so I forbid you to hang out with any angry man. And if you do, I'm going to kick you out of the palace. He never threatened them personally. Mm-hmm. They'd say, watch out for a loose woman. Here's the way she's going to come on to you. And I found in Proverbs about eight different ways a woman can come on to a man. And he lists these for them throughout the book of Proverbs, warning. But he says, so don't go near her house. But it was a caution. And throughout Proverbs, he kept saying, here's a good value. Here's what wisdom produces. Here's what will make you successful or effective in life. But if you make other choices, you won't be. Here's my simplest point. He talked to them. They were like his fellow adults.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't talking to them like they were his little kids. And that's what I had done with my oldest three. I was treating them with excessive control because I thought, because I found it in Scripture, I was sure I had my, nobody could ever refute the little book I wrote until I refuted my own book and threw it away as quickly as possible. In fact, I had this in a parenting teen series. I had more than $2,000 worth of videos and CDs I had just received from my studio. They're sitting on the shelf, and I said, I should listen to that. I haven't watched those videos in years. And within the first DVD, I realized this is awful. I'm imbalanced here. Mm-hmm. And I took the $2,000 worth of merchandise and threw it in the trash can. Some people would have put it on sale, I suppose, but that was poison. I thought, in fact, I have a standard on my website. If you own one of my original ones, Effective Parenting of Teens, you can mail it to me, and I'll send you a new set. That's how determined I am to replace anything I did wrong in the past, or I was imbalanced in this area of authoritarian. But Solomon talked to his teenage sons like they were adults making choices. So here's how it changed in my home. My oldest son, he's 35 now, was a cop for years. Now he's a private investigator and a political consultant of sorts. So he's 35. But when he was 17, 18, he'd say to me, Dad, I want to go watch this movie with so-and-so at the theater. And I'd say, son, that's on our no-watch list. No, that's full of sexual garbage and stuff. You can't see that. I decided it for him.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I believe I was wrong. And so my youngest son, who's now 20, when he was 17 years old, he says, Dad, so-and-so's invited me to watch this movie. And I say, well, I want to warn you, I checked that movie out, and it's full of sexual stuff. You're a young man who wants to walk in purity. It may be hard to watch that movie and walk in purity. He says, well, no, thanks, Dad. I don't want to go see it then. And I said, well,
right.
You know, I was actually thinking maybe you and I could go see this movie. And he says, Dad, no, John saw that. He says, that's really foul. We don't want to see that. So we were here as two men coaching each other. But I didn't make the decision for him. I cautioned him about what would happen. And that's because I didn't think it was my place. I felt it was demeaning to talk to a young man who was making decisions at 17 for his life and dictate to him what had to happen. And so that's
right.
What changed. That's from following Solomon's example, and I have no regrets. Because I watch the homes of people around the country. Because I travel, and I'm in the homes. I meet people. I watch their kids. And I see that those who watch their teenagers stay in good relationship and not go prodigal usually are ones who are not dominated, but ones who are simply encouraging their children to make decisions. In other words, not saying, here's the college you're going to go to, here's what you're going to major in, but saying, you pray over it, my 14-year-old, my 15-year-old. You ask the Lord to direct you, and we'll get behind you. We'll offer you our thoughts, but we're not going to tell you what has to happen. And that is foreign. In fact, there might be people listening to this broadcast now and thinking, no, this guy's wrong. No. I was the king of authoritarian control. I watched the fruit of it. I was mistaken. I caution anyone listening to this right now who thinks that is the only way to go. You know, I just caution any parent who thinks that way. I've watched the fruit of it. It does not match the biblical model. So that's why I feel passionate about this, as you can imagine.
Yes. And, I mean, I can really just echo your experience. I was definitely going down that hyper-controlling road. My husband and I both were with my oldest son when he was a teen. And I can say from my perspective that it really came out of fear. I was so afraid of him losing his faith, of him getting into trouble with, sexual impurity, with alcohol, just bad influences, because I have seen people, young people go the wrong way. And so, unfortunately, my initial impulse, and my husband's too, was we need to crack down more. You know, when we see that pushback from our son, we need to have even tighter restrictions on him. And really, only by the grace of God did I come to realize that it was just the opposite. I had a supervisor when I was first doing my year of supervised experience as a clinical psychologist in a Christian clinic, and the supervisor told me something very wise that, having boundaries for children is like having a fence, and you know that you have the fence in the right spot when the kids aren't constantly kicking it. You're just constantly kicking and kicking and kicking, because that suggests that you're not giving them enough freedom to make decisions and choices, not without, as you're saying so wisely, not without your counsel, but if we don't give them opportunities to make decisions now while they're in our home, what are they going to do when they're out of our home? They aren't going to have any confidence in their ability to make good choices, and we're not going to be there to help them negotiate all of these decisions when they're making them for the very first time. So.
Well, I got tested when my youngest son was 16. He said, Dad, can I go to public school? I want to play football on the team, and I want the public school experience. And I said, no way, no thank you. We homeschool for a reason. But I had to give a thought, and I thought, we'll see how you do. I groomed you for a reason. Some people say we launched them at 18. Hey, he was 16 years old. He was solid in his faith, and he was
mm-hmm.
strong, and he was outward thinking. I thought, you know, well, we'll see how it goes. And so we let him sign up at the local high school, and we said, here's the deal. If your grades suffer, then you're out of the school after the first semester. And so his grades suffered. He's a nice-looking guy, and he was fawned over by, you know, flocks of girls. I'm not exaggerating. And it was distracting him. And so we said, you know, your grades suffered. He says, I know. Back to home. So he was back to home, and actually we did finished out his schooling. He took the GED and finished his high school diploma that quickly. But the point is, it was rough. Because I'm a diehard homeschooler, but I let him make that choice. Now, I'm not saying every parent has to do what I did, but I am saying it was what I chose to do because I believed he was ready, and I wanted to allow him to make a decision and reap a consequence in his life, natural or otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the evidence, the fruit of this whole process of thinking. When parents are excessively controlling of their teenagers, they will regret it, is my only caution.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, you know, I know that many Christian parents who are high control parents believe that they have to do everything possible to protect their children because of fear, but we know that God didn't give us a spirit of fear, that we're not supposed to live out of our fear, but we're supposed to trust the Lord. And you know, that was a lesson that I have learned as well. And just, you know, my oldest son, our relationship with him has been completely transformed. And I look back at my prayer list from years ago, and I'm just in awe that the Lord has answered all of those prayers.
Mm.
So that's my encouragement for any homeschooling parents who are listening, no matter what kind of consequences you're reaping from a blind spot that you may have, that God is able. God is able to make changes in you. He's able to make changes in your child, in your marriage, in your family. And, you know, Rev, I know you're certainly a testimony to that, of how good God is.
Oh, yes. Well, you know what? It's nice is that as believers, we have the supernatural on our side. We have God who moves among human hearts. And in the world, they don't. They can just try one technique or one method or one principle. But in the Lord, we have him. In fact, if there's one nugget, I don't know how much more time we have, but if there's one nugget I want to give to people, the issue I have found isn't just control, process, curriculum, et cetera. I have a courtship series that I have on CD. It was what I was known for back in the 90s. I traveled the country doing courtship seminars because nobody else, very few others were doing anything like that. And so everybody's got their little process, their plan, how they're going to court, what it means to be betrothed, and how you go through. But here's what my conclusion is after all these years. It's not the process of supervising and controlling your children's courtship process. It is, do your children have a passionate love for Jesus? As I watch my youngest daughter, I'm not supervising her. She's 18. She's renting a room from someone. She works for a church, works in ministry. She loves it, goes on mission trips as often. She loves God. But that's what keeps her in the way. It's not dad controlling her, dad supervising. It's her love for God. So the best thing we do isn't just simply devise a plan of control for my teenagers. Or Bible study, it's having a genuine faith ourselves that's contagious to our children. Unfortunately, and this goes big. I mean, I do whole hour sessions just on this topic, but so often we fall into just our religious rules, our religious process, our religious formulas, and it's really about one thing. Do you have a genuine love for God in your heart? Or do you instead, is your Christianity primarily about avoiding bad stuff? What do your kids hear you go on and on about? avoid this, abstain from that, don't listen to that, don't watch this, don't wear that. So they grow up thinking that Christianity is primarily about avoiding bad things.
Mm-hmm.
That faith is not biblically accurate. It doesn't reflect who Jesus is. It's not attractive. What kid says to himself, I can't wait till I can grow up and avoid bad stuff?
That's right.
The height of Christianity. I mean, my daughter avoids bad stuff because she has a love for God. She has a love for purity and doesn't want to watch foul things. But it's not just dad or somebody else has created rules for her. She wants to walk in the purity that's in her heart to do. And that's what I'm getting at here, is that as parents, it isn't about the process and the rules, whether it's courtship or parenting or control. You want to do the best favor for your kids? You have a walk with God that's sold out and in love with Him. And instead of just daily devotions or disciplines and your catechism, it's go get on your knees, listen to the heart of God in the morning, get off your knees and gather your kids and say, here's what I saw in the heart of God today. In other words, be somebody contagious to them so that they will develop, hopefully, that same passion for God. It's not just about the rules and the abstinence and the, all that kind of thing.
Right.
I hope this makes sense.
It absolutely does, and I'm so glad that you made that remark, because it's so vitally important. You know, we want our children ultimately to love us and to want to have a close relationship with us. And that is such a big part of it. And not just even with our children. I mean, that's all of our relationships. If all we do is talk about all the bad things that are going on, and boy, do we have a lot of things to talk about today. I mean, we can do that, and we can talk about, you know, what this group of people is doing wrong and this group of people. That is not appealing to anyone. So we want to have that time with the Lord and let it change us. Let Him fill us with His love so that it just overflows into our relationships with our kids, in our marriages, and with our other relationships. So I'm so appreciative that you mentioned that.
Sure.
Well, we are running out of time, but I want to make sure that everyone knows that I am going to list all of the fantastic resources that Reb has mentioned that he has in the show notes for this episode. To find that, you're going to go to ultimateradioshow.com, click on the Homeschool Sanity Show button, and look for the show title, Parenting Blind Spots That Put Your Homeschool Family at Risk. I could have Reb speaking with us for multiple shows, and maybe I will in the future, but I feel great about sending you to find his resources. Reb, where is the best place for people to look for these kinds of resources that you have available?
Well, our primary website is familyministries.com. That's the primary website. There are other links. I have a political commentary website, rebbradley.net. I have the one for husbands, ultimatehusband.com. And so that's the best way to go to familyministries.com. You'll find free materials there, downloads, articles, and things like that.
And do you have your speaking schedule on your website as well?
I do.
Wonderful.
So things are slowed up a bit right now. I mean, we have commitments that aren't just speaking, that I'm doing a number of weddings this May and June back in California. But no, we're going to be in, let's see, we'll be in Canada this weekend and Iowa, and just got back from Indiana, going to be in Denver, and in California, at Modesto. So there's a few things on the horizon here in 2014.
So do check on his speaking schedule on the website. And
right.
Also, Reb mentioned to me that he does have a free download of his seminar on MP3 of Solving the Crisis in Homeschooling. Is that correct?
That's right.
All right. So if you want to hear more, and really, who doesn't? I have been so inspired and encouraged by this interview with Reb as well. But if you want to hear more, that would be a great link to grab a hold of and download and listen to later. Well, Reb, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to share with our listeners. And if you know a homeschool family who is struggling with some parenting blind spots, it can be a little awkward to point it out to them. But you can certainly say, I listened to Reb Bradley on the Homeschool Sanity Show, and it was really wonderful for me. It was what I needed to hear. I thought you might like to listen. I hope you will do that and share it with your homeschooling peers. Thank you so much, Reb.
Sure enough. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for the Homeschool Sanity Show with Dr. Melanie Wilson. Visit Melanie at psychowith6.com. That's the number 6 for more sanity-saving ideas. The Homeschool Sanity Show is a production of the Ultimate Homeschool Radio Network.